You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 316, Divorce and Remarriage in the Old Testament with David N. Stone Brewer. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing, Trey?
Doing pretty good. Can't complain. How's the school of theology going? Y'all getting that under control?
Isn't that a good way to put it? Under control. Yeah, we're a few weeks in now, and so now we know who's submitting work and how many people are going for the certificate, and it's about three quarters of the people enrolled. So we've got about 120 live and another 700 in distance. So lots and lots of grading to do, but we'll get through it. We'll staff up, you know, for next year, but it's a really, really good start. But again, a good kind of busy.
I'm sure you've missed grading papers since you left Liberty. I bet you're excited.
There's a lot of, there's a lot I could say about that. But these assignments are real short. So I didn't take the shackle back and put it back on my ankle. So it's not that magnitude of grading drudgery, you know, which every professor of course knows what I'm talking about. But, yeah, it's good. It's good.
Well, this is our first podcast outside of Exodus, so it's we've got several interviews lined up, and this is our first interview of several. This will be a two-parter covering divorce and remarriage in the Old and New Testament, and I'm excited about this topic. I know you get lots of questions about stuff like this, and it's going to be great to have a reference podcast to refer back to listen to for answers, so...
Yeah. I feel the same way. Yeah. I feel the same way, you know, because I do get questions on this. So it'd be nice to say, hey, you know, here's a book we recommend here. Here's a discussion we had. You know, I have to telegraph to everybody up front, though. We're not going to entirely escape Exodus. You know, we are going to dip into Exodus in this podcast, I imagine anyway, having read David's book, I think, you know, that'll pop up. But it's a good example of, you know, when you go through Exodus, you can't land everywhere, you know, and there are a few verses in Exodus that are actually going to matter for this discussion. So we're not quite entirely away. we can't quite get there, Trey.
Well, at least it's Bible study related. I mean, you know, at least we're out of that for Exodus.
Yep, so. Agreed.
All right. Well, let's not keep David waiting. Let's get into it.
Well, we are thrilled to have David N. Stone Brewer with us all the way from the UK. David, I'd like you to introduce yourself to our audience briefly first. You know, just tell everybody who you are and a little bit about your academic background and what you do.
Hi, I'm David. I'm a Baptist pastor, though I've been seconded by the Baptist Union into the academic world, which is a great place to be because I'm at Tyndale House, where I get to meet all the best scholars from around the world. They come for their sabbaticals and breaks and to do further degrees. So I get to meet everyone just by standing in one place. And that place is a very nice place in Cambridge. So I've got a lovely wife and daughters. So I'm in a good place.
Yeah, it sounds quite good. Tell us a little bit about Tyndale House. What is its purpose?
It's an academic research institute in Cambridge. It's attached to the university, but not part of it. We have arguably the third best library in the world, maybe the best, but among the top three for biblical studies, the others being the École Biblique in Jerusalem and the Pontifical Institute in Rome. Mm-hmm. And it's just a superb place to do research because everything is there in one little place. And if by any chance we don't have the book, 5 minutes down the road is a library with another 8 million books.
Right. Yeah, they should have it then. Yeah. You know, now before we you know, transition to our actual topic, I mean, I would like people to know about your website as well. So I want to do that here before I forget it, because you've been, I think it's fair to say, at the forefront of providing digital resources online for biblical study. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about that?
Yeah, I rely on computers because I have a very poor memory for most things. So I make make tools for using on computers with their various things. Step Bible is probably the most important one at the moment. That's Step, one word, Bible, stepbible.org or .com. And that's for reading the Bible in any language you want to read it. I think there's 280 languages there. And it takes you straight through to the Greek and Hebrew if you want to go there. And you can then explore as deep as you like, or just read the Bible along with any number of other Bibles in parallel or interlinear or linear. It's a great thing just to play around and read the Bible.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, that was sort of our initial attachment, because I was at Logos, and of course we had heard about you, and you know, I know there was some back and forth there, and eventually you came in to do a mobile ed course, and so we've had an attachment of sorts, you know, over the years, you know, obviously at a distance because you're in the UK, but I've read your work in a number of different areas, and did an article through the journal that you edit, the Tyndale Journal. And so, again, we've had this attachment, you know, on and off, back and forth. And I've been accustomed to your scholarship. And when I get questions a lot on divorce and remarriage, you know, and I'm not a pastor, I'm a geek, you know, I don't really have a whole lot of experience, really, you know, talking to people directly about, you know, these kinds of issues. I mean, obviously we all run into it either, you know, in our own, you know, efforts to maintain our marriage, or, you know, relatives, you know, people in our family. So everybody sort of experiences this in some way. And in the course of getting questions, I have, you know, looked at your book, you know, off and on a number of times, you know, just to get some guidance. And I figured after this latest round, I got peppered with, I don't know, three or four, you know, more questions, kind of all in succession a few, you know, months back. And I thought, you know, we really need to do this on the podcast. And, you know, what better source could there be other than David Instone Brewer? And I not only want to promote your book, and before I forget about that, this is a terrific resource, David's book. Why don't you just, you know, tell, you know, the audience a little bit about the book, you know, when it came out, what the reception's been. So I want to promote that because I do think it's a great resource, but to actually have you on the podcast, really, we're going to do two episodes, sort of an Old Testament and a New Testament. I just think is great for our audience.
Yeah, it's Divorce and Remarriage in the Bible. I brought that out in 2001 and followed it up fairly soon after with Divorce and Remarriage in the Church, because the one in the Bible deals with all the technical issues, all the different manuscripts in Jewish sources and Babylonian sources and early church sources. But in the Divorce and Remarriage in the Bible is not for the person who's in the pew necessarily. Mm-hmm. So I wrote Divorce and Remarriage in the Church to bring out the more pastoral issues and the applications. So I'm not quite sure which one you've read, Mike. I guess it was the Divorce and Remarriage in the Bible.
In the Bible. And this audience, believe it or not, I know, you know, if you get this book, you're going to see, you know, Greek and Hebrew in it and whatnot. But this audience is used to, you know, even if they don't have a year or so of either of the languages, they will jump into stuff like this and try to navigate it. So I figured, you know, it would be a good, you know, again, idea to do an episode on, you know, two episodes actually on the subject matter. And I think this is still a great resource. We value on this podcast, we value primary texts. We value taking scripture in its own ancient context. And this is the sort of book that if you're having to deal at all with a divorce and remarriage issue, you're going to want this as a resource. And so that's why, you know, I'm not afraid to recommend the big one, the one with footnotes and Greek and Hebrew in it. Yeah. But the, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned the other one.
The Greek and Hebrew is always translated, mm-hmm. because I recognize that, hey, why should someone need to know it all? And I always explain my sources carefully. So if it's a reference to an ancient document which really doesn't make sense in the first place, than I explain it. So it's not like these technical works which have reams of Latin which they don't bother to translate.
Right. Right. It's not like Mandelkern or something.
And I've been really pleased with the way in which academic institutions have received it. There's one institution that actually uses this book not as a way to teach ethics, but as a way in which to teach hermeneutics. How do we deal with a text? How do we interpret it? How do we look at the context? How do we look at the languages? How do we look at the culture and put it all together to find out what the text says? And they use this book for that, which I was really surprised at and wonderful.
Yeah, that is really, that's actually a good idea. I mean, now that I actually hear somebody doing that, it's like, yeah, you know, that would work well. You know, why didn't I think of that before? Yeah, that's a great idea, because it really is a good model for that. So yeah, I encourage everybody listening to check this book out and get it. It's a great resource. So with having said all that, I want to jump in here. Again, this episode, we're going to be talking more or less about Old Testament. We'll see how far we get, but I'm hoping we get into the Second Temple period. We can sort of set up the next episode, which is really New Testament focused. But to jump in here, you begin the book with a chapter on the ancient Near East, and you emphasize in that chapter that marriage is a contract. Okay, this is a legal contract in the ancient Near East. And then, of course, that is something you're going to take into the discussion of the Old Testament material. But could you unpack that a little bit? Because I think a lot of people in the audience who are Christians, you know, sort of tend to think about marriage more ethereally, like, oh, it's, you know, just something that in the sight of God, this and that. But it's actually a legal thing. I mean, we sort of know that in the modern world, but I have noticed that there's something of a tendency to kind of theologize it too much, you know, to sort of take it out of its contract moorings and its context. So to start with, what kind of contract are we talking about here? What, you know, summarize that chapter for us.
Well, often we talk about marriage as a covenant, but in Old English, covenant and contract were exactly the same thing. It was an agreement between two people with stipulations and usually with penalties. If you don't keep your half of the covenant or contract, then there's a penalty to you. Or if the person doing a deal with you doesn't deliver, then there's a penalty.
That doesn't sound romantic.
Doesn't. No. But the two words, contract and covenants, have gradually split apart. And actually in America, covenant means something rather different in law than it does in the UK. In UK law, a covenant is something which you inherit as part of who you are. So if you buy a house, you inherit a covenant, which puts various limitations on how you use that land along with the house. Or if you have a job, there'll be a legal covenant which is part of that job. It's not something you have to sign in order to have to fulfill. In America, a covenant is an agreement which doesn't have penalties attached. It's you keep it just as a matter of honor. And I think it's that meaning which has come into the sort of sense of marriage not being a legal thing. It's a matter of something you do because you're a decent person and you keep the laws of marriage. But these are just ways in which the language has developed. In the Old Testament, there's just one word. It's berit, which is for all covenants, all contracts. And they have penalties. They have clauses. It's legal jargon, you know. Laban makes these contracts with Jacob, or you have Solomon making contract with Hiram to deliver wood. And if Hiram doesn't deliver wood, then Solomon won't pay by sending his end of the deal. And there's no friendship involved. It's just a contract. It's just a berit. It's a covenant. It's legal. And when you come to marriage, you've got exactly the same thing. They have a document which you still know about from the modern Jewish marriages. We have this long marriage contract, which delineates exactly how much money is coming in from both sides. And it says in the old versions and from Jesus' day that the woman's going to be doing the cooking and the man's going to be providing the food, and that each side has obligations and each side will receive things. And it's a contract.
Yeah. What are some of the, you talked about, again, terms. In your book, you cover terminology for payment. Okay, there were different kinds of payments. So let's talk about some of the ingredients, if you will, the elements of the contract. Other than I'm going to do this, you're going to do that, there was actually money or property or wealth transferred mm-hmm. to sort of cement this agreement.
Well, the place in the Bible where we see this most strongly is, of course, when Jacob tries to get his wife and gets married to the wrong one and then has to work another 7 years for the right one. Mm-hmm. And there's very clearly a payment being involved there. Different parts of society and different parts of the Old Testament have slightly different customs, but the mohar, the payment, the bride's price, is the common one in the Old Testament. And it's strange in different parts of the world. You have either that you have the groom having to pay or you have the bride's family having to pay. And I've never figured out how this comes about one way or the other. But we still have payment in our marriages. That's why you have the exchange of rings. Mm-hmm. It's what the lawyers call a consideration. Without a consideration, there's no contract. And the consideration that we give is a ring. And you only have to give the bride a ring because in our culture, the money comes from the groom. But nowadays, we tend to exchange rings. So there's still this concept of a price being paid. And of course, in some cultures, it's absolutely terrible. Indian cultures, there's huge payments. And a lot of African cultures, people just can't afford to get married. So we still have this payment, and this, which is part of a contract.
Yeah. Do you think it's fair to say, okay, again, just going back to, and there's bound to be somebody in the audience who, you know, this has popped into their head or they've heard it. But again, this notion that, well, I don't want the state involved, you know, in marriage. The state shouldn't be have any say in whether I'm actually married or not. I'm going to promise myself to this, you know, this person, and in the sight of God, that's good enough. So I think, you know, it would be fair to say that really wouldn't be a biblical marriage because you have this exchange. Do you think that's fair?
In the Bible, you have things exactly like that. It is called being a concubine. The definition of a wife, in contradistinction to a concubine, is a wife has exchanged vows with the husband before witnesses. If that hasn't happened, then the woman is a concubine. Mm-hmm. And the legal difference is a concubine doesn't have the ownership of any children. The children all belong to the husband. The concubine can be sent out of the house at any point, and the concubine doesn't have legal rights to any property. Mm-hmm. But for a wife, the wife shares the property of the husband and shares the rights to children, though it's not quite the same rights that we have nowadays. But it's very close model. The concubine is very, in many details, is exactly like what we call a common law wife, someone who is living with a man without a public ceremony of marriage.
Now, that's actually a nice transition into, really, I think in a lot of respects, the kind of the guts of the matter here in the Old Testament. That's Deuteronomy 24 verses 1-4. There's also sort of this inclination or this assumption that, well, you know, back in the Old Testament, this is patriarchal culture and the women didn't really have any rights. They had no recourse. They're essentially property, so on and so forth. And there are patriarchal isms, just to use the most broad term that pops into my head, but the woman did have, you know, property rights here. And a lot of that goes back to Deuteronomy 24, 1-4. So I'd really like to spend some time hearing you talk about that passage in relationship to the contractual nature of marriage and, you know, how that really, honestly, you know, how that was a blessing for a woman. You know, that this contractual relationship.
Yeah, the situation you describe of a woman not having any property rights is, as far as we can tell, how it was in most of the ancient Near East. We have the remains of laws from Hammurabi and other law codes, and women are very much property themselves rather than owning property. And if you get dismissed by your husband, the children belong to him. They are valuable assets because they can plow the land and they can do work for the family business. And you just lose them. Or if your husband goes away sometime and you're not quite sure if he's going to come back and you marry someone else, well, when he returns, he can just claim you back and claim back any children that you've had in the meantime with this other man. So a woman really didn't have many legal rights. And that's why Deuteronomy 24 is so different. It just stands out as a gold standard in the ancient Near East, because there you can see that the woman, when she's dismissed, she has to be given a certificate of divorce. Now, without that, if she didn't have a certificate saying, yes, I'm divorcing you, you're now free to marry anyone you wish, then the man could come back at any point and just take her.
Mm-hmm.
So no one would marry her again because, hey, they're going to lose any children they've had in the meantime, lose all all the assets they've given to the woman. Anyway, you don't make any emotional commitment to someone who might just be taken from you. So having a divorce certificate like that was such a wonderful thing that there is a sort of equivalent to it in one ancient Near Eastern law where a high-level commander, when he goes off to war, he has to give his wife a divorce certificate in case he doesn't return. And then she's got something that can say, okay, I'm free to marry. And but that was a great privilege. And here Moses says it's for every single Jewess has this right, that if the man leaves her, he has to give her a certificate saying she's now free of him and she can marry someone else.
What about the, how does this play out into the latter part of the passage? We might as well just read it. I'll read it quickly. This is ESV, Deuteronomy 24. When a man takes a wife and marries her, if then she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some indecency in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, and she departs out of his house, and if she goes and becomes another man's wife, and the latter man hates her and writes her a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house, or if the latter man dies, who took her to be his wife, then her former husband, who sent her away, may not take her again to be his wife after she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin upon the land that the Lord your God is giving you for an inheritance. So, we tend to look at this, and I think... I'm just going to put it this way. I think we sort of read it completely negatively because of words like, indecency and defilement and things like that. But there's actually a lot more to it. So how does this whole thing work? If this is a great thing, for her to be given a certificate of divorce because it allows her the freedom to remarry without the fear of just being arbitrarily claimed. I mean, take us through this scenario of what these verses are actually describing.
With a case law, which you have in the Old Testament, you always define for rights the very minimum requisite to get those rights, and for obligations you get the worst case. So here you have a woman who is definitely in the worst case wife. I mean, she's terrible. She's been her first husband found some indecency in her, a matter of nakedness, it says. We don't know what it is, but hey, it's bad enough that he wants to get rid of her. And then she goes off and marries someone else, and he hates her and sends her away. And in both cases, this woman, you wouldn't expect this woman to get a divorce certificate, but the law says even this woman should get a divorce certificate. So the negative is there deliberately. This is the worst case scenario. And even that woman has to have a divorce certificate. So it's a right which is for everyone. But you're right. The actual case that's described here, it's abysmal, isn't it?
would a woman who has a certificate of divorce, does that mean to others that she was divorced legitimately, or this is on a, or is it just wider? It's really any case. Does this signify the rightness of the divorce, or is it sort of neutral?
We don't know what the wording is back then, but in the rabbinic times, they said the minimum wording that has to be on a divorce certificate is you are now free to marry any man you wish.
Mm-hmm. So that's the minimum legal statement that basically the husband has to say yes to that. Yes, you know, this is what's written on there, and give it to the wife. So like he couldn't take that out, is what you're saying. That's the minimum requirement.
Yeah. And he can't say, and you can only marry, hey, you can't marry so-and-so or something mm-hmm. like that. You're now free to marry any man you wish. They did allow them to add a Jewish man, because obviously a Jewess wouldn't marry a non-Jew. But yes, that wording is very similar to wording we find in that that case of the senior military man. They have wording very similar to that. And it's also very similar to wording that you find in other Neo-Babylonian documents. So it's quite likely this wording does go right the way back to the 1400s or whatever, when Moses was giving his laws. That wording would make sense in this situation, because, as you say, he's not saying anything good about her. He's just saying, okay, I'm done with you, mm-hmm. and you're now free to go off.
Okay. And so, again, the scenario is actually, if, let's say she goes out, she has the certificate, so she's allowed to remarry, regardless of what the circumstance was. She is allowed to remarry because she has this certificate. And then she gets married again. And then the worst case scenario, like you said, the second husband, again, hates her, quote unquote, you know, from verse 3. And he also writes her out a certificate of divorce and puts it in her hand and sends her out of his house. So I presume that we assume that it's the same kind of document. He says, hey, you can get married again, but I'm done with you. Or again, if the latter man dies, he sends her out of his house, or if the latter man dies, so she's, sort of by herself now, obviously. Then her former husband, though, is not allowed to take her again. Why? What is that preventing?
That's a mystery. I haven't seen any convincing explanation of this. This is a bit of case law, and this is how Old Testament works for some of the laws. Some of the laws are lists of regulations. Some of the laws are cases, such as with the Sabbath law, that they find a man picking up sticks, and therefore they decide, no, that is work, and that mustn't be done, and you mustn't light a fire on the Sabbath. You get case law, like in the US and like in the UK, case law builds up into actual law. So mm-hmm. this is an actual case. Something has actually happened like this, and we don't know exactly what it is, why they're saying this second time she can't go back to her former husband. And there are some theories. You've probably heard of some of these theories.
Is this Westbrook's idea about the first husband would essentially be trying to, if the second, let's put it this way, if the second dowry, if she comes into money with the second marriage, that he's going to go and try to reclaim her? Is that what you're thinking of here? Let's just go there. Why don't we unpack that? Because Raymond Westbrook is an expert in ancient Near Eastern law, for those who are not familiar with his name. And he has sort of a take on this that is interesting. The first marriage ends, and, he writes the woman, the wife that he's sending away, a certificate of divorce, just like you should do, for whatever the matter of indecency was. Again, that's pretty nebulous. But the fact that, again, if he did have a valid ground for doing that, let's just, again, we have to assume that, but like he had, she had broken, the marriage agreement or something, however they define, the validity here, then what happens to her dowry, that she is given at the beginning of the marriage? I mean, there's that issue. What happens to that? She goes and remarries and she gets another dowry. And the first guy says, well, that one's bigger than the one, that we had. And so I'm going to try to reclaim her so I can get to the money. I mean, do you think there's any validity to that idea?
I think it's a great idea. It's a very creative Right? That's the mild British way of saying no. It won't work.
So you don't think there's enough evidence for Westbrook to make his case, is what you're saying?
Well, it isn't written in those terms. It's not written in terms that you can't keep collecting dowries. It's written in terms that you can't marry any wife like this that you've been married to before. And why not? She can marry a complete stranger. She can marry someone that she's committed adultery with. She can marry anyone, but she can't marry the person she was originally married to, which is weird.
And right. And because it is weird, that people have been looking for ways to explain the logic of it.
Yeah.
It's
very strong language. It's an abomination, a word that's usually used for idolatry. It's a religious thing. It's the whole country is going to be defiled if this happens, and it's just a money thing.
Do you think that he's also reading the validity angle in? Because again, if the indecency is really undefined, how can you be more precise than that? You know what I mean? It just how do you apply any precision to that?
I don't think this is supposed to be precise. It's
right.
It was an actual case, but they want to bring generalities out of it. And so they're not going into the precise details of that case because, hey, it's got to become general law. But this not marrying the original husbands. I have a pet theory.
Okay. We like pet theories.
It's a pet theory.
They're okay if they're clearly labeled.
Yeah, I haven't written it up in a scholarly journal, so I haven't had any comeback from other scholars about it. So I'll wait for your experts who are listening now to come back and say it's rubbish. I came across this when I was looking on Sunni websites I was just interested in Islamic law. Mm-hmm. And no, it's Shiites. It was the website of a prominent Shiite cleric who was giving answers to questions. Amazing. People were asking all sorts of questions. And they were asking about this pleasure marriage, the Amuta marriage. You can look it up on Wikipedia, a Amuta marriage in Shiite law. What it means is you can marry someone just for a short period. You can enter into a marriage agreement with a girl, with a woman, for a few nights and then end it. And it's just temporary, just a temporary marriage. Mm-hmm. Now, they don't recommend this. This isn't something that's is a terrible scandal in Shiite Islam. It's just something that they've inherited and it is still practiced. But, I'd almost say under the covers. But
right, they're not out there flag waving for it.
Yeah, no.
It's still there, yeah.
It's still part of Islam. And presumably it was part of the culture. And probably part of the hospitality culture. And you can imagine that someone comes along, hospitality is so important in Arabic culture, and including before Islam was learned by the Arab tribes. And you give them every comfort you can imagine. You give them food, you give them the best place in the house or in the tent. You can imagine you give them also a wife for the night. But when Islam comes along, it says, well, you can't just do this. You've got to actually have a marriage ceremony. So you have a very quick marriage, and in the morning you say, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, and it's over. And the woman can go back to her original husband who divorced her for the night. Yeah. It's legal. In Islam, of course, you have to have 9 months a certain number of months to make sure the woman isn't pregnant from that temporary marriage before you remarry her, but you just remarry her. And if that was happening in Moses' time, this would be the exact way in which they would stop it.
Right, they would stop it, yeah.
If a man divorces his wife and someone else marries her, then the man can't then go and remarry his wife. That's an abomination before the Lord. And suddenly that language, that very religious language and very strong language, makes sense. He's pimping his wife.
Yeah. Yeah, and you're right. You do get the abomination language you know, it is religious language, but a lot of the cases are, you know, that you find the term, you do have these sexual transgressions, you know, that are in Leviticus and whatnot. So, you know, I know you said it's a pet theory, but sure sounds good. I mean, it makes sense. But, you know, who knows if that's the case. But, yeah, I could see how this would just stop it right in its tracks, you know. So I understand why this has appeal, you know, to you. All right, so you're sure you're not going to submit this for publication somewhere?
Well, I'd love to find some corroboration in an ancient Persian text or something, but until I find that, it's really just a kite flying in the air.
All right, well, you need a website then. you don't need peer review for the website. You just throw it out there. But it is interesting. I mean, all kidding aside, that it really would halt this with some immediacy. I mean, you'd be very, very. I don't know if you really loved your wife. I don't know anybody that would do this. You know, they wouldn't incur the risk. You know, and not being able to take her back again. Why would you do it? So yeah, again, that I can see where that has a lot of appeal. So we have Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 4. Again, the nature of it is somewhat nebulous as far as why the divorce occurs. But I think it's fair to say the important takeaway, again, for our discussion, really, and this is going to ripple out into other passages, both Old and New Testament. The important takeaway is that the woman who was given this certificate of divorce, whatever the cause was, the reason, she is allowed to remarry. Okay, that much is clear. So how does this relate to what we see later on in the Old Testament, like when we get into the prophets? Because when you talk divorce and remarriage, you know, somebody's going to bring up the prophets, and they're going to find, you know, the verse that says God hates divorce, and then they're going to, you know, there's this language about, you know, God divorcing Israel and so on and so forth. So how does this Torah information in its context relate to what we see in the prophets?
Well, it's directly related to what we see in Jeremiah, because Jeremiah is sees God divorcing Israel and is got a complete angst about this, because he knows he can't remarry Israel, because Deuteronomy 24 says that you can't. Mm-hmm. So in Jeremiah 3 and 4, that this is a big, big topic. Of course, the main subject of Jeremiah there is that God has divorced Israel and he's about to divorce Judah, and Judah had better turn around and make sure that doesn't happen. That's what he's using it to warn her about. Mm-hmm. But he says here at the beginning of Jeremiah 3, if a man divorces his wife and she goes from him and becomes another's wife, will he return to her? Would not the land be greatly polluted? It's exactly the language of Deuteronomy 24, so that's clearly in his mind.
So does this mean that God's a polygamist? You know, he's married Israel and Judah. How do you handle that language?
Well, of course, in the Old Testament, it wasn't wrong to have more than one wife, but God didn't set out to be a polygamist. It's just his wife turned into two.
Right, so that's probably not going to happen.
I've just been watching Altered Carbon, you know, on Netflix.
Okay.
And you have this concept that you can be double sleeved. You can put yourself in two bodies. So maybe it'll happen.
Yeah, somebody will figure out a way to do that. Yeah. Yeah. So we have the case of Jeremiah. What about some of the other prophets? I mean, is it, you know, let's divide it up into a couple questions. So is it proper to say that God divorced Israel? What would the grounds be? In other words, does this terminology, does it apply, or how does it apply to the question of individual divorce and remarriage? And then why does God say, I hate divorce? You know, put that together for us.
Well, certainly Jeremiah does talk about God divorcing Israel and separating from Judah with the danger of divorcing her. And so does Isaiah. Isaiah says, well, you know, where's your mother's divorce certificate? It refers to the divorce certificate of Israel. Mm-hmm. And they are talking about God as being married to Israel, and because of her adulteries and things, he divorces her. And Ezekiel goes into details exactly what the reasons are for that divorce. He doesn't just talk about the idolatry as adultery, which all the prophets seem to talk about. He also says, well, look, I gave you food and you gave it to the idols. I gave you clothing and you gave it to the idols. Mm-hmm. I gave you love and you loved the idols instead. And all the grounds for divorce, which are in the Old Testament, including those three, which we haven't looked at yet, are cited for God's divorce in Ezekiel. And
well, let's pick that up, because, you know, you right there is the list. These are common things, common stipulations. Again, let's use the legal language here, common stipulations that, you know, are part of the marriage contract. And so when the stipulations are not met, you know, you have legitimate grounds for divorce. So what are the stipulations? You just mentioned a few of those, and then how they show up in the prophets.
Yeah, we find them in Exodus, in the covenants, in Exodus 21. You have the obligations to the very lowest form of wife. That's a slave that you've decided to marry. Mm-hmm. And if you decide you don't want to be married to her anymore, you have to... if you decide you're going to take a second wife and then you sort of neglect the first wife, who is the slave wife, you still have obligations to her. And it lists those obligations in verse 10. If he takes another wife, you cannot diminish her food or her clothing or her marital rights. That last word is difficult to translate, but marital rights is probably it's as good as any. So food, clothing, and marital rights. And those are the obligations that a man has to his wife. And if they are, and it says, if he does not do those three things for her, she can go out for nothing without payment of money. She's free from that marriage. And even though she came as a slave, she's absolutely free, and that there's nothing to pay or anything.
Right. She doesn't have to pay him.
You know, I mean, yes.
There's no cost to her. Yeah.
She doesn't have to buy her freedom. She's completely free because he hasn't fulfilled her obligations in marriage. And the rabbis quite sensibly took that as the minimum things that you have to give to your wife in marriage: food, clothing, and marital rights, and of course faithfulness, which they got from Deuteronomy.
All right, so if a woman says, you know, to whatever the local, you know, legal authorities or the rabbis, again, however we want to characterize that, look, my husband is not giving me enough food or clothing or marital rights. And I know in your book you talk about the possibility this could be referring to conjugal rights. But any one of those things, again, whatever they were, and if the whole case is examined, and yeah, she's right, you know, she is being deprived of whatever this thing is, or one of these clear things, then she is allowed to leave. In other words, that those are legitimate grounds for divorce, correct? Are we reading that correctly?
Correct. And also the other way around, a man could say that the woman is not cooking the food, and she's not sewing together the cloth into clothes, mm-hmm. and she's not reciprocating marital rights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, you could, this is the bare minimum, again, like you said. We do have these things listed in Exodus. It gets the same language gets picked up in the prophets to talk about the legitimacy of divorce. And right away, we've already sort of moved beyond what, you know, how divorce and remarriage typically get talked about in the church. You know, it's usually only one of those, the conjugal rights, if we're reading that correctly. And specifically, there's like an unfaithfulness situation or adultery. But in Exodus here, this would have been a legitimate divorce if she or he is being deprived of one of these other things.
Yeah, we tend to see these verses as obscure, hidden away in a part of the Bible we don't often read, and who knows about it. But in the first century marriage contracts that we have, they're found on Masada and in the mm-hmm. Judean caves, along with Dead Sea Scrolls and things, in every marriage certificate which this part of it is preserved, you find this verse being quoted. And it says, you must not diminish her food, her clothing, or her marital rights. It was written into a piece of paper that every Jewish bride owned and kept safe, because that was her ticket to freedom if the marriage went wrong.
And to remarriage.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
She wasn't just stuck, you know? So, again, just that, and the fact that, you know, if it's written into these marriage certificates that are, you know, the marriage certificates, and of course, you know, the reverse, the divorce certificate, you know, I'm sure you're going to get some of this. That tells you that it's not these Exodus verses, which seem peripheral to us, were not peripheral. I mean, this is how they're reading it. They're serious.
Yeah, we see it with the Babathra documents. That's a woman who was on the Mount Masada, ready to give her life with everyone else. She had a packet of documents, her family documents. And it was marriage documents were the most valuable pieces of paper that you owned. You know, forget about your social security number. It's your marriage documents, which is going to be that save you and give you an income when that horrible man ditches you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So how does this relate to Hosea? Because that's always at the forefront, and, you know, of any of these discussions. And there, you know, because of the nature of, you know, the story and Gomer, again, our mind sort of defaults to the sexual infidelities, and we never really get to Exodus 21. But I mean, we have to bring Hosea into the discussion. So how is that a factor as well?
It's a lovely story, isn't it? And I don't mean that facetiously.
I know, because of the sacrifice involved and all. Yeah.
Yeah. What's that movie where he goes and marries his prostitute, his mistress?
Is that Pretty Woman? Is that?
That's it, Pretty Woman. Yeah, it's such a moving story.
I've seen parts of that, but that was a good guess on my part. So.
Oh, very good, very good. This is the Pretty Woman of the Old Testament, if you like, where he has to go and marry this whore, this prostitute, and he has to love her, because that illustrates how fanatically in love God was with Israel, even though she was going through all these men, all these idols, and being unfaithful under every tree on every hill. And yet God still loved her, and I was determined to bring her back. And although I say that Jeremiah is stuck because of Deuteronomy 24, he does find a way round. What Jeremiah says is, oh, it's okay, because Israel and Judah are going to come back together again and be bound as one stick, you know, be one people again. And therefore, that she can be married again, because Judah herself wasn't actually divorced. And Isaiah, he has a completely different solution to the same problem. He says, well, clearly, you know, Israel is divorced, but no, it doesn't matter. They're going to be reborn as a new bride. And he says a newly virgin bride. Mm-hmm. And it's a wonderful image. But whatever, they can see that God is going to be so fanatically in love with Israel that he will find a way in to get round these laws and get back together again with his beloved. And somehow he's going to win her over. And that we don't see the solution to until he gets a New Testament. We just can't see how God is going to win this love affair.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So this is the gist of the Old Testament material, you know, God's situation with Israel, the split there with Israel and Judah, some of that divorce language. You know, we've got essentially the lesson of, you know, Hosea is that God is committed, you know, to the relationship. I know that there, you know, there are some passages that, you know, you could legitimately read as though that, yeah, God got divorced to Israel, like you just said, but, you know, he has a plan to reverse the situation in something that's totally innovative and new. Could we say that God was sort of forced into that decision, but again, has this backup plan? Is that fair to throw that in the mix as well?
Yeah, it comes to a point where just continuing is just multiplying sin. Israel wasn't going to turn around. She wasn't going to change anything. And there was nothing but a decent man could do except end it. We find in Malachi, God hates divorce. And hey, have you ever met a divorcee who doesn't?
Yeah. And again, even though you have that situation, you know, God hates it. This isn't going to change. So we're going to go through with this. It's not that his hands were tied, but that's where all the circumstances are driving this decision. It's not something that God wants, but, you know, like you said, this is what, you know, a decent husband would do. But God still has a commitment through all that, again, shown in the book of Hosea, that somehow, again, supernaturally or, you know, in a totally unexpected way, this is going to come full circle and be reversed somehow. And we can already see that how some of that, you know, would apply, you know, to our own, you know, marital situations. In principle, perhaps, you know, maybe even, you know, all of it, maybe not in this lifetime, especially if there's a divorce between believers and, you know, there might be a sort of a hopeless situation. But, you know, what I'm getting at here is sort of leading up to a question, how much, and we'll hit this when we talk New Testament, but I'm going to throw it out here anyway, because I'm going to turn it back into the Second Temple community. But how much of this can we really use analogically to our human marital relationships? I mean, how much of it really applies, and in what way would it apply? So that is a thought that we're going to have to take into the New Testament, but I'll just leave it here in the Second Temple period. Obviously, people get married. They run into problems. They know that this information is in their sacred texts. So how did they do this? Like, how did they apply these passages? And again, some of them are pretty nebulous. They're not clear. They don't have the precision we'd want. What were the school or schools of thought in the religious community in the Second Temple period for applying all this stuff? How'd they do it?
Well, we have the writings of lawyers and how the lawyers applied it. I think even for us, the Old Testament is important in that we see God as a divorcee, and there's so many divorcees in churches who are just rejected because they might be completely the innocent partner, but because they're a divorcee, they can't be an elder, say, or they can't even be a member in some churches. We have to always remind ourselves, well, you know, being a divorcee isn't necessarily a bad thing. God was a divorcee, and you're not going to let God be an elder in your church.
Yeah, well, again, it sounds silly, but honestly, you know, if you're going to press one passage into service to answer an ethical question, okay, or bring it up to interpret what Paul says about the qualification for elders, if you're going to do that in, you know, with one Old Testament passage, on what grounds do you exclude others? You know, so I do. You know, I tend to agree there. There's a method question here that often gets avoided in the discussion. You know, how consistent are we? You know, in taking the Old Testament instead of just using it to angle for the position we've already sort of decided we're going to land on. You know, how consistent is that really? You know, I think that's a good question that we need to ask ourselves. And you're obviously, you know, doing it now, and you've done it in the book. So can you elaborate on that a little bit, you know, just in terms of method, you know, how might we do it? You know, how did they do it in the you know, Jewish community?
The Jewish community, we have to divide in half at the point of 70 AD, because that's when Judaism came together as one community and followed one halacha, as they called it, one way, one interpretation of the law. Before that, there were many, many different schools who had differing viewpoints. And although they were fairly agreed on marriage things, that there was a very big division on divorce. But the principle that everyone followed was that a marriage stayed together and couldn't be broken unless someone broke a vow, broke one of the stipulations in the contract, if you like. And then a divorce could happen. So if someone didn't, was unfaithful, or if someone didn't supply the food and clothing, or if someone wouldn't take part in conjugal relations, then a divorce was possible. But until one of those stipulations was broken, that the marriage couldn't be ended.
You know, if you just think about that, if you didn't have a legitimate out, then what you're saying is, well, you have to stay in this contract even though the other person broke it. It doesn't, you know, it seems, when you think about it just in contractual terms, that seems pretty odd.
There is one situation in the Old Testament where that's the case. Okay. If you rape a woman,
all right,
then you have to marry her and you can never divorce her.
Mm-hmm. So there, you got crime and punishment, yeah.
Yeah, she can be as horrible to you as she likes for the rest of your life, and you've got to take it.
And chances are she would,
I guess.
Because of the circumstance, you know. Chances are good if she was, you know, if there was no way to, you know, get out of that.
It wasn't compulsory. Up to the father, and presumably the father would listen to the daughter. Mm-hmm. But it was one way of that she would be supported for the rest of her life. And she would not have to do what he said. So it's not ideal, but it's not bad either.
What is the, this will be our last question for anything that we would call sort of Old Testament leading up to the new, you know, for the next episode. But we often hear about the Shammai and Hillel division in Judaism about divorce. And of course, you know, that affects remarriage. So can you give us a sentence or two about that to sort of set up or at least provide a segue when we get into the Gospels? You know, is it lawful for a man to divorce, you know, his wife for any cause? And the, you know, some of the different wordings we get there. So there, people in the audience are going to know that there was this division of opinion within the Jewish community about what was a legitimate cause for divorce. So give us a few sentences about that.
Yeah. Well, we know both Hillelites and Shammites accepted Exodus 21, because they both make regulations about what exactly, how much clothing, how much food, how much marital rights has to be given. So they both agreed that those were grounds for divorce. But the Hillelites, they were genius. They managed to find a ground for divorce in Deuteronomy 24, which they called something like any cause, an any cause ground for divorce. Because they said, well, it says here that this woman was divorced the first time for some indecency, or it's evat devar, which is a rather strange phrase. It means something like indecency of a thing, evat, nakedness, devar, a thing, a deed, a clause, a word. So indecency of a thing. And they said, well, look, this can be two things. Indecency, obviously, that means adultery. And then you got a thing.
So they took the two words and took them in two different directions.
Yeah. So they said they've got two grounds for divorce here. You got indecency and you got a thing. And it doesn't say what thing it is. So it's anything. Right. Anything will do. If she burns a dinner, that's a thing. If she's got wrinkles that I didn't see when we got married, it's a thing. Anything will do.
So the Hillel schools is the no-fault divorce.
Yeah, you don't have to find anything. No fault is what we call it.
Yeah. And the other school would say what?
Well, they were more traditional. They, as I said, they took Exodus 21 like the Hillelites did. But when they looked at Deuteronomy 24, they said, no, there's only one ground for divorce there. That's adultery. That's the only thing there. It's just a single phrase. Evat devar is just a single phrase. It's not two clauses. It's one clause. And the there's nothing but adultery in Deuteronomy 24.
Yeah, like you said, isn't that clever? You know, there you have two words. What could be simpler? Well, yeah, two words mean two things, or two words equal a phrase that means one thing. And so you know, the ramifications are quite dramatic. I mean, that's quite a difference.
Yeah, but you've got to stand on one side or the other.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to make a decision on this, and that's why they went to Jesus. And they said, well, what do you think? Does it mean one thing, or does it mean two things?
Yeah.
Does it mean any cause, or what do you think?
Well, that's a good place, you know, to end. So I want to thank you for spending, you know, this time with us with respect to what the Old Testament says. And when we have you back, we'll hit the New Testament. So thanks for being here.
That is great. Great talking to you.
All right, Mike. Wow. I'm looking forward to the next episode next week. when we get into the New Testament about this topic. So yep. This was a good one. And also his resource, he mentioned stepbible.org.
Yeah.
Which I'm on Step it now Bible. Looking at it. Yeah, it's pretty cool. What is that about again?
Yeah, it's a good resource for not only providing the Bible for free and lots of translations. You know, people are probably more familiar with something like Bible Gateway, you know, to look, you know, at scripture passages in different translations. But Step Bible is multilingual translations in all sorts of languages. And again, it is a site that allows you to penetrate beyond the translation into Greek and Hebrew with digital tools, all for free. So David has been trying to do that for a number of years. So he's sort of been at the forefront of providing free digital resources to people who want to do things like word studies. So it's a site I certainly recommend.
Yeah, that's awesome. And what is his book again?
Yeah, there's two of them, Divorce and Remarriage in the Bible. That's a more, you know, hefty academic work, you know, lots of footnotes. Again, you get Greek and Hebrew in there, but it's always translated. And then Divorce and Remarriage in the Church. Again, that's a sort of a smaller version, kind of like what we did with Unseen Realm and Supernatural. So there's two of them.
All right. Yeah. I'll be looking forward to that one. I'll have to get that on my to-do reading list of my mile-high stacked books of books to read.
Yeah, I got one of those too.
Yeah, you got one of those? Yeah. All right, Mike. Well, yeah, that was a great conversation, and I'm looking forward to next week's, you know, about the New Testament. And, you know, we want to thank David for coming on to the podcast, and we look forward to him next week as well. And I want to thank everybody else for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.